Today, our portrait of Jesus is going to be one, just like the one last week, that we don't have very much personal experience with. Last week, we talked about the portrait of Jesus as our great high priest. We live in a culture where essentially there are no priests, and those who sometimes wear the name priest are far from what the Bible talks about as being priest. And so we don't have a very adequate picture of what a priest is, and especially a high priest. But fortunately, in the Scriptures, we have a very good picture painted, first of all, of what God intended for His high priest to be in the Old Testament, found in the book of Exodus and Leviticus in particular. And then how Jesus is our great high priest, as described in the book of Hebrews. And now our portrait for today, Jesus as King. Again, this is a portrait that we don't have much personal experience with. Sure, we watch movies that have kings in them, and we've heard the stories and maybe even read books that had the stories of maybe King Arthur or some other great king. But we don't actually live in a monarchy. Our entire experience, personally, is with a republican, democratic form of government in which we participate in the selection of our leaders. And they answer to us very directly because they can be unselected after they've been selected. And yet, in other forms of government, and in fact, the most common forms of government in our world up until very recent years, are those in which one single person, in effect, is the ultimate ruler in that nation. And we still see that today. So we don't have much experience in being ruled by a dictator or the chairman of a certain party like we're seeing right now in North Korea, or by a king. Yes, this past year we had splashed all over television and news media for several days a royal wedding, but even that doesn't come close to what we're going to be talking about today, because the royalty we're talking about is a royalty that is only or almost entirely just a figurehead today in England. The Queen and her husband, the Prince Philip, and now children and grandchildren, in this case a grandson, getting married. And yet they're not true monarchs in the sense that the world normally knows a king to be. They only hold that position in a figurative way today as compared to biblical times. So today our portrait of Jesus is our King has come. And to do something of a sufficient job of this, I'm dividing this lesson into two parts, this week and God willing next week. And today we're going to talk about just two parts of it. First of all, we're going to talk about what God's picture in the Old Testament was of a king, what his expectation of a king was. And then number two, God's promise in the Old Testament that he was going to send his king to rule over his people. And then next week, we will have the opportunity to look at how Jesus was the king who was to come. And how God did that, like God does almost everything else, in a very different way than what man would have expected. But Jesus was that king that was to come. And then after we see that, we will take some time to see what are the benefits and the blessings and the ramifications of him being our king. That'll be next week. But first of all, today, what was God's intention for kings? Originally, God was the king very directly over his people. When we start the story in the beginning of Genesis with Adam and Eve, and down through the book of Genesis with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and his sons, and then their descendants going down, they and their descendants going down to Egypt and living there for several hundred years and becoming a great nation. During all that time, they had no king on earth. And yet God, through all of that, described himself as their king. But at last, when they had come back into the land that God had originally given to Abraham, the land of promise, the land of Israel, and under Joshua, they conquered it from the people who now live there, and they took it over. For several hundred years, they lived there still without a king. And that period of time is covered by the book of Judges. Because as necessity arose, God would raise up men, and in one case, a woman, to be judges over them. And by judges, the word judges at that time had in mind two things. First of all, a deliverer. Someone who could serve as a military leader to deliver them from their enemies. And secondly, a judge in the sense more classically, like we use it, who would make sure that justice and judgment was carried out among God's people. So people would do the right thing in their relationships with each other. And that's what the book of Judges is about. And then as we come down to the very last one of those judges, we have a man by the name of Samuel. And Samuel served in at least three different roles. First of all, he was a judge of God's people. He helped deliver them from their enemies. Even though I don't think actually read of him putting on any kind of armor and taking up a shield and putting on a helmet and charging at the head of an army of people. Nevertheless, he was their military leader in helping deliver them from their enemies. But he also made sure that justice was carried out among God's people, that they kept the law of God, that they obeyed God and treated each other the way they should. But he was also a prophet, God's spokesman, revealed God's will to his people. I said he had three roles, it was actually four, because the fourth one, he was also a priest, and he stood between the people and God. He wasn't ever high priest. He never was. That term was never used to describe him, but he was a priest. And so he went to God on behalf of the people, and then he went to the people on behalf of God. That's what a priest did. And in the days of Samuel, the people decided they wanted to be more like the nations around them and have a king. And this greatly distressed Samuel because he knew that meant that they were, it appeared, rejecting God's way of ruling over them. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 8, we read this story of Israel asking for a king. And there seem to be several things that precipitated that request. They were not unhappy with Samuel, per se, but Samuel was getting old. And it was unclear who was going to replace him. Now, it turned out that Samuel lasted a lot longer than they thought. Even after they said he was getting old, he still lived and served for another 35 years after that. God bless us all to be able to do that after we've grown old. But on top of him growing old, his sons were nothing like him. They didn't have the kind of devotion to God or the devotion to the people that Samuel did. And I think the people could see that Samuel's sons would not be adequate replacements for him. But they also looked around at all the nations around them, and they were the only nation that they could see that didn't have a king. And so they wanted a king who could lead them to victory. In other words, be a military leader over their enemies, and who could be an established, recognized force for judgment and justice. And so Samuel takes this to God. We read in 1 Samuel chapter 8, and in verse 6, "But when they said, 'Give us a king to lead us,' this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to him, 'Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected as their king, but me.'" You see, because God really was their king. He really was the one who was leading them in victory. Samuel, in a sense, was almost just a figurehead for God. Because Samuel didn't have either the strength or the wisdom by himself to actually be a military leader. God was actually directing him, and God gave them the victory. And even Samuel's judgments and justice was based entirely on what God gave him, God's word, the law that had come through Moses, and the wisdom and insight that God would give him in specific cases on how to do things and what to do. It was really God who was already their king. And so God is telling Samuel, they're rejecting me as their king. And so a man was chosen. God participated in the process. And the man who was chosen, I think we need to realize, was a man that the people thought would be a good king for them. And God actually blessed that choice. He participated in the choice and singled him out. He was a man by the name of Saul from the tribe of Benjamin. He had several outstanding characteristics. He was highly respected by the people. He was taller than most other people, so he really stood out. He was a humble man. And so that actually commended him in a lot of ways to people, because he didn't seem to be arrogant or proud. He didn't seem to be clamoring for the office. And so in these regards, he would be the kind of man they thought they wanted to be their king. And so God blessed that, and he had Samuel choose him to be their king. And we can actually go back to the book of Deuteronomy, to the days of Moses, and see God already anticipated this happening. Because Moses, before he left the people, and this would be hundreds of years before Samuel lived, Moses had already given directions about the day in which they would have a king. Deuteronomy 17 and 14, Moses said to the people at that time, and it was in their book, it was in the books of Moses, "When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of and settled in it, and you say, 'Let us set a king over us, like all the other nations around us,' be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not a brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And when he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the priest, who are Levites. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his brothers, and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel." Look at what God is saying through Moses that the king was supposed to be. Number one, he was to be the one that the Lord chose. It says, "Be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses." So it needed to be someone that God chose. Number two, he needed to be one just like them. He must be from among your own brothers. Number three, taking it out of order in which it appears in the scriptures here, he was not to consider himself better than his brothers. That's what it said down in verse 20. It also says that when he becomes king, he should not acquire great numbers of horses. Now, horses were only representative of a much larger military buildup that they would have done. Horses at that time was the cavalry of your army. You didn't get very far if you only had foot soldiers and the other side had cavalry, because they would not only outflank you, they would overrun you. And so the king was not to gain great numbers of horses. Why would God have given that instruction? Because it would mean the king was trusting in his military rather than in God. More than that, he was not to take large numbers of wives to himself. And he says why? Because they would lead his heart away from God. He says that they were not to accumulate large amounts of silver and gold, because this would end up making the king not only the richest man in the kingdom, but all the things that would come along with all of that wealth in his life would cause him to be distracted from his true role, his true purpose. On top of that, he was to be one who took his own personal copy of God's law and read it all the days of his life, and to be faithful to it. He'd be held accountable for obeying it, so he should have his own copy of the law that he would read all the days of his life. And if he did all of those things, if he was one God chose, he was from among his brothers, he did not think of himself as better than his brothers, he did not build up his great military or his great wealth or take large numbers of wives, if he constantly focused on what God's law said and obeyed it and didn't turn to the right or to the left, then he and his descendants would be blessed in their role as king. We're hearing here the beginning of a picture of what God expected his kings to be, the kings over his people. But there's other things that God had to say as well. Of course, they had, as we've already noted, they needed to be those who could not only lead their people in victory, but they also needed to be those who would be the very foundation of judgment and justice in their nation. As we've been reading through the book of Proverbs in our Bible class, we've heard a number of those proverbs that were directed at the king himself as the one who is to execute judgment and is to seek out or see through the devices of the wicked and be able to discern what is the right thing to do and to take care of the poor and uphold that which is right. That was the role of the king. He is designated, as Samuel says when he goes on to make Saul the first king, and then later when he selects David to be the next king, he anoints them. They actually go through a ceremony in which the king would be anointed with oil and the blessing of God would be pronounced upon them. And they, from that time forward, 1 Samuel 10:1 with Saul, and then later again with David, they would be called the anointed of the Lord. I hope you're will be in your mind, if not on a piece of paper, filing some of these things away, because when we get down to seeing Jesus, we're going to see these same things in reality in him that sometimes was only figuratively so of the real kings of old. The king was anointed, and he was called the Lord's anointed from that time forward. The king often was dressed in a royal robe and wore a crown of gold, and had the royal scepter, the symbol of his authority and power. He acknowledged, according to Isaiah 33:22, that while he was king, that he had a king, that God was actually king over the king. In the prophets particularly, we read that the kings that Israel had often failed in their responsibility, and they were referred to as shepherds of God's flock, who had failed in their responsibility. So here we have this picture of what God expected the king to be. One he chose from among God's own people. One who did not turn to the right or to the left. One who did not trust in military might or riches. Who did not let his wives lead him astray. Who shepherded God's flock. Who truly was God's anointed one. And he saw that justice and judgment prevailed among God's people. That's God's picture of what a king should be. It doesn't accord very well with whatever pictures we have today of kings in the world. We mostly think of just the parts of it that God thought should be minimized. Great military power, total dictatorship, opulence, riches, great palaces, great pomp and ceremony. God had very little use for any of that with his kings. And yet that's usually what marks out kings in their reigns today and in our pictures of what the kings were. So that's what God's picture of the king was. And now then, when we start reading about God's promise of a coming king, we know what he had in mind. We know what kind of king he had in mind, because he's already described what a king ought to be, and now we start reading of his promise of a coming king. And really, it seems to me the first promise of a king is a promise that God made to Abraham and Sarah. We go all the way back to the book of Genesis. We find that when God speaks to them, I didn't write down the passage, I thought I'd just remember it. But when he speaks to them and he changes their name, do you remember when God changed their name in Genesis 17 from Abram to Abraham. And he even changed the name of his wife from Sarai to Sarah. And it says concerning her in particular in Genesis 17 and in 16, I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. Now that's the part we usually focus on, that God was promising that Abraham and Sarah would have a child. And that turned out to be Isaac. But there was more to that promise. It says, I will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings will come from her. So God was promising that part of the blessing that was going to come from Abraham having a son, and then this whole nation that would come from him, would be that kings would come from their descendants. And so they have a son, Isaac. Now Abraham had another son besides Isaac. His name was Ishmael. And then in his old age, after Sarah had passed away, he married again and had six other sons. And so of the eight sons that we know of that Abraham had, only one of them was the one through whom the promise was going to come, and that's Isaac. Isaac grows up, and he marries, and he has two sons, Jacob and Esau. But it's only going to be through one of those two sons the promise will be carried on, Jacob. And Jacob has 12 sons. And we know somewhat about that story as it all plays out in Genesis. And I'm sorry, when I was a kid in Bible school, I could name all 12 of them. I would struggle now to name them right off to you at the moment. But we know that in his old age, as Jacob gathers these sons around him, he pronounces to each one of them a blessing. Sometimes the blessing sounded more like a curse. The truth is, the blessing was more of a prophecy concerning each one of them. And of one of those 12 sons, just like God chose Isaac instead of Ishmael, or any of the six other sons Abraham had, and God chose Jacob instead of Esau, and now God is going to choose just one of these 12 sons of Jacob to be the one. And so in Genesis chapter 49, it says, starting in verse 8, this is as Jacob is blessing his sons. Normally, in Hebrew families, the firstborn son received the special blessing. So far, God hasn't kept to that plan. Ishmael was born before Isaac was. Esau was born before Jacob was. And now, in Jacob's 12 sons, Jacob is going to go to the fourth son in order of birth to pronounce a blessing on him. Because it says in Genesis 49 and verse 8, Judah, the oldest son of Jacob, was Reuben, followed by Simeon and Levi, and then Judah. But he says, Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. He's describing the one through whom the kings will come. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. A lion was, in ancient times, just like modern times, often the symbol for a king. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter, that's the royal stick that a king held, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. It moves from describing the prophecy for Judah himself down to a prophecy about this descendant of his. It says that eventually Judah's brothers will look to him to be their ruler. And people will fear him just like they fear the lion and the lioness. And it says that once the scepter is put into his hand, and again, it's not thinking just of Judah specifically, because Judah never himself was a king, but one of his direct descendants was. And once that scepter was put into his hand, it did not depart from Judah until it finally passed into the hand of the one that God had designated to be the true king. And of that true king, it says of him that the obedience of the nations will be his. We'll talk about next week how that was fulfilled in Jesus. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch of the vines, or the, you know, the grapevines was the symbol of peace and prosperity in Israel throughout their entire history. When they were overrun by their enemies, they had no chance to plant their crops and their vines. They had no opportunity to enjoy the harvest from them. And so he's describing a time when this individual becomes king, in which there will be peace and there'll be prosperity. And it says he'll wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. That's just showing how great the prosperity will be. Wine will be like water. And there's probably some symbolism involved in this as well, because describing his garments as being washed in wine will mean his robes looks like they're bloodstained. It turns out his robes will be bloodstained. And his eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. In other words, his health is being described here. So here's this prophecy of Judah about a coming reigning one. And so this is picked up on in the Old Testament, and we read it over and over again. The Psalms are loaded with passages about the coming king. Psalm 2. We'll just sort of touch on these. You can go read them at your own leisure. But in Psalms 2, it says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against His anointed one." But it says, "The one enthroned in heaven laughs, and the Lord scoffs at them. Then He rebukes them in His anger and terrifies them in His wrath, saying, 'I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill.'" After Saul was king, even though he would have been the people's choice, and so God blessed that choice, he failed miserably. We might note that he was not of the tribe of Judah. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. And so the next person that God had Samuel anoint was a young man by the name of David, the youngest son of a man by the name of Jesse, who was of the tribe of Judah. And when David became king, God promised him that because of his faithfulness to God, that his descendants would be kings, and that eventually one would arise who would be the king that God had been promising would come. And so in Psalms 2, this is probably a psalm written by David himself. But he's not talking about himself when he says the Lord has installed his king on his holy hill. He's looking forward to that day in the future, and God is going to install the Almighty King to reign over His people. And again, in other psalms like Psalm 45, Psalm 89, Psalm 72. Psalm 72 is the one in which it predicts that the king who's going to come is going to be greater than Solomon. Do you remember Jesus ever saying something about someone greater than Solomon has come? Psalm 72 said that's when the great king comes, that's what he would be, greater than Solomon. Psalm 110 predicts that not only will he be a king, but he'll be a priest. We talked about that last week, that in order for a priest to be king or for a king to be priest, the law would have to be changed. Not just make a change in the law, but the law itself would have to be changed out for another law. The whole system of law. Isaiah 9. He's called the Prince of Peace. And it goes on to say that he will reign on David's throne. In Isaiah 32, he will reign in righteousness and justice. In Isaiah 33, it says, "Behold the king's beauty. He is Jehovah our king." In Micah chapter 5, it says, "The one who would reign over them would be born in Bethlehem." In Jeremiah chapter 23, it says that he will be David's righteous descendant. He'll say in Jeremiah 30, in effect, that he will be David himself, reigning over them again, even though by the time Jeremiah is speaking, he's speaking almost 350 years or so after David had died. And yet, Jeremiah also says in chapter 22 of the king that sat on the throne at that time, a young man by the name of Jehoiachin, he was the last king in the line of David. It wasn't the end of David's descendants. He was just the last man in the line of David to reign as king. And Jeremiah will say in Jeremiah 22, count this man as if he were childless, because no descendant of his will sit on the throne after him until he comes whose right it is. That literally came to pass. No descendant of Jehoiachin sat on the throne after him. Now there was one more king after him. He was Jehoiachin's uncle. And none of his descendants sat on the throne either. But after Zedekiah, Jehoiachin's uncle, was king for about 8 or 9 years, the Babylonians came in and took away the nation, destroyed the city, destroyed the temple, carried them off to Babylon. Those that were carried away during that time joined those who had been carried away during the 20 years before, and they're there in captivity for a total of 70 years until finally God declares that Babylon has come to an end and they've been replaced by the new Medo-Persian Empire and the people can go home. But when they come back, they have no king. They have a governor appointed by the king of the Medes and the Persians who reigns over them. And the prophets who speak during this last period of time, particularly Zechariah, which is next to the last book in the Old Testament, that makes it an easy way for me to find him. Zechariah, as he speaks during this return time, says concerning the king in Zechariah chapter 6, in verses 12 and 13, tell him, and the him here is the high priest at that time named Joshua, tell him, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Here is the man whose name is the branch. So God isn't saying that this man was there in Joshua's time, but he says, look, I'm showing you a picture of what's still to come. Here is the man whose name is the branch of David, the offspring of David. And he will branch out from his place and build the temple of the Lord. It is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty, and he will sit and rule on his throne, and he will be a priest on his throne. See, here's another of the prophecies that when the great king would come, he would be both priest and king. And there will be harmony between the two. And then again in Zechariah in chapter 9, the verse that Don read to us at the beginning, it's calling on the people to look forward to this time and rejoice. Zechariah 9:9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. When kings rode on animals, they rode on one of two kinds. They either rode on their horse when they were going out to war, or they rode on their donkey when it was a time of peace. It was symbolic. And here comes Israel's king, Zechariah said, and what is he riding on? A donkey. He brings peace because he was going to be the Prince of Peace. And yet we don't need to forget the other part of him. He will be a great military king too, because he will conquer his enemies according to Psalms 2. He will subject them to the will of God. So there's God's expectation of what a king was to be, and here are the promises, at least some of them, of the coming king. I suppose of the promises in the Old Testament about the coming Messiah, the promises about the king are the most numerous. I know there's at least 20 promises in the Old Testament that the one who was to come would be king. So maybe we could forgive the Jewish people in New Testament times when they were looking for a king. And maybe we can at least understand, but not forgive, the paranoia of old King Herod whenever the wise men show up from the east and say, "Where is the one who's been born to be the king of the Jews?" And he immediately calls in the elders of the Jewish people, because Herod wasn't Jewish himself, even though he professed to worship in the way the Jews did, and said, "Where is this king supposed to be born?" And then he sends out the soldiers to try to kill every male child born there in the last 2 years, because he is afraid that the king is coming. And he's trying to thwart the very plans of God. We'll look next week at how God carried out the fulfillment of these things. Our king has come. Kevin has an invitation song for us. We enjoy living in a democratic society. We enjoy the privilege, whether we always take advantage of it or not, of voting and participating and choosing our leaders. But we're part of a much greater country than this great United States. We're part of the heavenly kingdom. And we have a king. We didn't choose him. He chose us. And when it all comes down to it, we owe far greater allegiance to him even than we do to this nation and to the rulers of this nation that we live in physically. For he is our king.